Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Good to have you all with us. We're about to talk to Dave Zirin. On the way there, I want to remind you all, as I would tell you here, to follow us down the rabbit hole with costumes, art auctions, performances, and Masters of Motown. The Belvedere's as the Patterson is transformed into a wonderland for Alice in Wonderland themed 2012 Marquee Ball. I will be the MC. You can come dance, enjoy free food, beer, wine. It's a big dance party, and you can call, where's the number? 410-276-1651. Or go to creativealliance.org. That's 410-276-1651. Join me at the Marquee Ball. It'll be a blast, and it's this Saturday night. But right now we're about to talk to Dave Zirin, who, of course, writes about politics of sports for The Nation magazine, host of his own show on Sirius XM, The Edge of Sports Radio, The Edge of Sports on the web. His most recent book is The John Carlos Story. He was on here with that, with John Carlos. And we're talking about his most recent column, Big Trouble in Little Havana, The Perilous Politics of Ozzy Guillen. And Dave, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be here, Mark.
Now, well, how does he say his last name? Did I say that wrong?
Guillen,
right. So this was amazing to me when I read it. And I knew immediately you'd write something, so I was waiting to see what you were going to write. That here we have a manager of a baseball team who is told he has to take a walk for 5 days because he spoke his political mind. That's unbelievable. Dave?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Mark. He wasn't even speaking his mind, it's worth saying. I mean,
I mean,
this is very thin politically. That's why I've been saying over and over, Mark, that this story is not about what Guillen said. Because what Guillen said is about as benign as two pieces of bread with nothing in between them and calling that lunch. All Guillen said was that it's impressive that he respects Castro for being alive for 60 years in power without being killed. He didn't comment about Cuba's economy, healthcare systems, state of civil liberties. It wasn't deep at all. It was just him sounding off and frankly saying things that he said in Chicago when he managed there for the White Sox back in 2008. He said, I respect Castro because he's managed to stay alive. I mean, it's hardly high praise. But this story is not about what he said. It is about the rabid right-wing exile community in Cuba that is so well-connected, so financially powerful, so incredibly well-versed in having politicians jump when they crack the whip. And that's why you've seen every major newspaper, every major politician in South Florida call for Ozzy Guillen's job because of this. And what the story is also about is the fact that the Miami Marlins just opened a $2 billion publicly funded stadium in Little Havana that had already upset all the locals, black, white, brown, Cuban, Haitian, Jewish, everybody was mad about this stadium. And the last thing they needed was this kind of publicity.
Let's talk about a couple of things you just mentioned, because I think these really are at the heart of the matter as well, because we talk about him being silenced, but as you write in your piece, this is the guy who's all over the place, Guillen, all the time, whatever he says. He can say two different things at the same time. You know?
he's very famous for, like, if you said, like, I was on the radio show, a different show today, with a right-wing radio host, so first of all, let me say it's very great to be on with you, Mark. someone sane as opposed to someone right-wing. And what the person kept yelling is, like, I have these quotes from Ozzy Guillen about how much he loves Hugo Chavez. And I said, first of all, so what if he does? That's his right if he wants to. Hugo Chavez is the democratically elected president of Venezuela. Second of all, I could read you 10 quotes where Ozzy Guillen throws Chavez under the bus. The point is that this is a baseball manager who has an admitted drinking problem, who is not exactly renowned for his political acuity. He's much more renowned for saying 50 different things for 50 different people. And the idea that it's being taken so seriously, like I said, is so much more comment about the Cuban exile community and the scared nature of the Miami Marlins ownership than it is about Guillen's politics, which are all over the map.
You know, as my wife said about this morning, as we told her we were going to try to get you on today, she lived in Miami for several years working in the Haitian community as running the refugee center. And she said, you know, until you get down there and live there, you have no idea how powerful, vehement, and dangerous huge elements of the community are, the Cuban community are. To what ends they'll go to.
Yes, and I would add to that, my mother, born and raised in Miami, all my grandparents are buried there. I know the city very well. It's also very dangerous to assume that these very powerful, very well-connected Cuban exiles, people who were, they or their relatives were the allies of the dictator Fulgencio Batista, we shouldn't confuse them with the much more recent immigrants and the younger generations who, according to polls, want to normalize relations with Cuba and want to be able to see the land of their ancestors and are much less hardline than the older generation. That's why there was all this talk in the news about the uproar over Guillen, and uproar, and there was this huge demonstration to get him fired, and the demonstration was 150 people. Now, that to me says something about the gap between the actual forces on the ground of the anti-Castro masses of Miami and the people who have the power to make mayors, congresspeople, senators jump when they crack the whip.
What you just said is also very real and very important. The head of schools here in Baltimore City, Andres Alonso, is a Cuban-American who came over when he was 12 and one of the last waves, grew up in New Jersey, which is a very different community. And he said on his program one day, he said, look, he has no love for Fidel Castro, he said, because what he did to his family. But he said, what gave me my sense of social justice and commitment to working with poor children and changing things was the fact that I grew up in Cuba in a society that cared about poor people. And that so
yeah, and that's the very complicated thing. That's why they talk about Castro and they say Castro is Hitler, and it's like you can't even say his name without spitting if you don't want to earn the ire of some of these powerful entities in Miami. As Ozzie Guillen found out, it's like you better be prepared to say that Fidel Castro is the devil incarnate and Cuba is the devil incarnate. And I think I was looking at this and I just kept thinking to myself, if you don't want to get in trouble, you better just praise dictators that the United States is on friendly relations with, and then you'll be just fine.
The other thing you talked about was the stadium built with $2 billion of taxpayer money smack dab in the middle of Little Havana, which does have some good restaurants. But that's key to this as well. I mean, $2 billion?
Over 40 years, yeah, of all taxpayer money, $660 million this year. And that's not even the worst part of it. The worst part is that it was executed with so much transparent graft that it just drove the local populace nuts as this was being built. One example of it was the Florida Marlins. Now they're the Miami Marlins, but when they were the Florida Marlins, they kept saying they were going to move the team if they didn't get this new stadium because they were losing money hand over fist. And then Forbes magazine came out with this assessment of the club that said that they were actually making about $50 million in profit every year. And when they were questioned about this from the city council, the owner of the team, Jeffrey Loria, and all his financial people, they just looked at him and said, Forbes is completely wrong. It's not true. They haven't seen our books. We're losing money. It's ridiculous. Well, then you had the sports version of WikiLeaks. And someone actually dumped all of these documents that, because of antitrust laws, fans never get to see about the actual financial state of major league teams. And what we found was that Forbes was absolutely correct, and they had made $50 million. And this might sound like a small story, but in Miami, this was huge. This was a volcanic story. It's like, wow, they just lied right to the face of the city council. So we would give them tax money for stadiums so they wouldn't move the team. So already you have all of this ill will and mistrust. And one of the reasons this is so ironic, but that they hired Guillen, was that because his first language is Spanish, and they thought, hey, this is somebody who can help sell the new stadium and the team. But yikes, they didn't do their homework.
Well, you know, he's a guy who's in the bottle, Venezuelan, he's not Cuban. But one thing you also wrote about this week, before we have to take a break here and go in about 3 or 4 minutes, is that you wrote a really compelling piece about the NBA and so many of the players who came out and supported Trayvon Martin. And I kept thinking about how many players come from the streets themselves, and how many, even so many of the white players kind of grew up or played a lot in the black world, and they all kind of came out around Trayvon Martin, which was a very powerful statement. I didn't see it anywhere else in the press other than what you wrote.
Well, it's a shame it didn't get picked up more, and I can tell you that certain big sports outlets wanted to do this story and then had it killed by higher ups. I know this on very good authority.
I'm sure that's true.
Organizations, but I think people can figure it out. But the problem about it not being picked up as a bigger story is that what it does is it actually mutes what I think was an incredibly powerful gesture, on par in many ways with what John Carlos and Tommy Smith did in 1968. Because what Carlos and Smith did is they were really bearing witness to struggles that were taking place both in the U.S. and internationally. And what LeBron James and the Miami Heat were doing was bearing witness to the fact that if they had been wearing a hoodie and got in George Zimmerman's sight line, they very well could be dead as well. And that's the case they were trying to make. I mean, they were really asserting their own right to survive. And I keep thinking of what one of the Miami Heat players, Wayne Wade, said, which he said, the reason why I'm so glad we did this is that a few weeks ago, I asked my son what he wanted for his birthday, and he said a hoodie. And as a father, I'd like to be able to get that for him without thinking I'm putting his life at risk.
I think these kind of stories, we always talk about, and we've talked about on the show before, how many athletes do not get politically involved, don't want to be involved in social issues, but there are a lot of NBA players who come from poor working class families. They feel it, they know it,
yeah.
And they will say it, but people don't cover it when they do, as you just said. It just doesn't come out.
Exactly. It's one of the tricky, very contradictory things about being a professional athlete in the 21st century is that because of the absence of a social safety net, because of the industrializations, I mean, athletes tend to come from even poorer backgrounds now than they did a generation ago. But the difference between now and a generation ago is that the wealth, the amount they can make, is so much higher. And that, of course, means the stakes are so much higher. Because you're not returning home to a stable community if you don't make it. You're returning home to a very, very immiserated, dilapidated environment if you don't make it. And when there's that kind of pressure, it can act as a countervailing force to keep an athlete from speaking out. Yet at the same time, we also see that when there is enough struggle in the streets, they do speak out. Because what the Miami Heat did, it was great, but it doesn't happen without the 40 high schools in Southern Florida who did walkouts after Trayvon was killed.
Right.
And one had everything to do with the other.
Dave Zirin, it is always a pleasure and honor to have you on the show with us, even just for a few minutes this time, and look forward to it again very soon.
Oh, my privilege, Mark.
Thank you so much. And folks, go to edgeofsports.com. Check out the website. It's one of the best around. He makes the commentary on sports like no one else does. So we're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to come right back and meet some activists in this community. It's called Faith Communities and Food Access, people fighting for food access on the east side of Baltimore for decent food for families. And we're coming to that right after this break, so stay with us.